comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! It's Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Welcome, fellow nerds, I say, and I say it with endearment to the first ever, the debut episode of Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. My name is Greg Mahochko, and I'll be your guide, your host, whatever you want to call it, through the kingdom of Nerdville. And I'm very excited, very honored that I get to sit down with a new DC writer. His name is Van Jensen. You may have heard of him on the independent circuit in titles like Pinocchio, Vampire Slayer. He's also done some magazine editing. And as we sit down with Van, very excited to talk about this because we share a little bit of geographical background. I am in radio and have been in radio for almost 10 years now. And at the age of 30, I started when I was 21. From Southern Illinois, but I got my career started out in Western Nebraska, the Northwest, the Panhandle, and that's where Van is from. Van, you born and raised in Llewellyn, Nebraska, just on the western edge of Lake McConaughey. And my first question to you is, where was your nearest comic book store?
That's a good question, and thanks for having me. The nearest store would have been, there was a bookstore in Ogallala, which is about 45 minutes away, 45, 50 minutes away, Hoax Books, and they had a good number of comics. There was a store in Llewellyn for most of my childhood until it burned down, and it was literally called The Store because it's not like there were two stores in town, so you would get confused. And the store had maybe like three issues per month, so I could usually get like Spider-Man and Batman there. So until I was probably like 10 or 12, that was pretty much all the comics that I got to read. I guess a little bit of Larry Hama's G.I. Joe.
And those are probably on the magazine rack next to, you know, the Times and the People's and the Sports Illustrated and the fitness magazines. They're all kind of in there together, I imagine.
Yep, exactly. It was a little, tiny little rack by the front door.
So you're from Llewellyn, Nebraska, which I probably, and I'm, this is maybe a bit of a stretch, but I'm guessing there are probably more words that you wrote, more printed words in your first issue as writer of Green Lantern Corps, coming out November 12th. This upcoming Wednesday, and Green Lantern Corps 21. Probably more words in that than there are people in Llewellyn.
Yeah, that's a safe bet. I would say there are probably more words over the course of two pages than there are people in Llewellyn. I think last census, Llewellyn's down to around like 230 people, 220 people, but it was always about 300 when I was growing up.
I actually just drove through Llewellyn back in April. I was out that way in Scotts Bluff for a wedding, go through Llewellyn. Obviously, it's a nice way to get to Ogallala and back to the interstate, if you've never been through Nebraska, Interstate 80. So I know exactly what you're talking about. It's a small, close-knit rural community. And I guess I'm wondering, about what age did you become interested in comics? You say you saw them at the store as a kid, but what age did you look at the colored costumes and say, this is pretty cool?
Let's see. So I had a cousin who grew up in, he was in Seoul, South Korea. His family had moved there. And I'm trying to think. So he could get these comics over in Korea that, it was like 5 cents a copy or something crazy like that. And he would bring these whole like a couple of backpacks full of them to Nebraska to come visit and just, spill them out on the floor. And I think I was like 4 years old and I was digging through his comics, and actually kind of a weird coincidence. The favorite comic book series of his, this is my cousin Josh, was always Green Lantern Corps. So that was one of the first books that I ever read.
And coming full circle, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is now you are taking the helm and the pen for Green Lantern Corps. But let's talk a little bit more about your background. For many boys in Nebraska, it's their dream to not only make it to Lincoln and go to the University of Nebraska, but play for the Cornhuskers. Your path that led you a little different.
Yeah, I played 1 year of football in high school. Actually, half a year. I quit midway through the year. I was pretty terrible. This is how bad I was as a football player. When I was in grade school, I was the center on our team, and there was one play that I forgot to snap the ball. So that should give you a pretty clear picture of my football prowess. I guess it was when I was in high school, I was always really interested in sports. I love sports. I'm actually more of a basketball fan than a football fan. And then I had started to really get into writing. Both of my grandmothers are writers and poets. And so it just had really developed as an interest. And I had this kind of like aha moment where I was like, I like sports. I like writing. I should do sports writing. So that led me to the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, which has a great journalism program. And I just plugged into that, worked for a while as a sports writer covering, you know, Nebraska athletics. Pretty much every athletic program there, even like the rifle team, I wrote stories about at one point or another.
And you, we were talking a little bit here beforehand, but some interesting stories that you saw or observed, some things even led you all the way to the steps and into the Capitol there in Lincoln.
Yeah, so my senior year, I ended up as the editor-in-chief of the Daily Nebraskan, which is the student newspaper. And that was during probably what's like the worst era of Nebraska football in the school's history, which was North Platte native Steve Peterson was the athletic director. And he had just fired Frank Solich, hired Bill Callahan, which, you know, we all know how that turned out. And
if you're not a college football fan, it did not turn out very well. I'm a Husker fan.
Yes.
I'm a Husker fan myself as well. So I know the Bill Callahan era is usually met with groans and other forms of displeasure from Nebraska fans. But I apologize for interjecting. Please continue.
Oh yeah. So we had an April Fool's joke issue every year, and that year we decided to just put something together that basically, you know, satirized Steve Peterson and kind of his tenure as athletic director, and really, you know, calling him out for some of the garbage that he had been doing and just mismanaging the programs, but in a, you know, funny way. I mean, you know, we're a bunch of 20, 21-year-olds who think we're hilarious, so it was probably not half as funny as we thought it was. But regardless, I think it was the day after that printed, I got a call from the state capitol, and Steve Peterson's father is a state senator in Nebraska, and he had seen our little joke issue making fun of his son and called me into his office at the capitol to have a meeting with him, where he went through his great displeasure with the performance that I had done as editor of the Daily Nebraskan.
And because of that, so much for your constitutional freedom of speech, you got a stern lecture and quite possibly a slap on the wrist as well.
Yeah, you know, there was a university official who went in on the meeting as well, and they really, you know, they really were trying to, you know, come down on me pretty hard over the whole thing. And I, at a certain point, I just realized, like, I'm in the right in this situation. Like, there's freedom of speech. We didn't break any laws. We didn't do anything unethical. You know, we said that someone who is doing a sucky job is doing a sucky job. So, I mean, people who are like, you know, two or three times my age, and I basically just said, like, listen, you know, free speech, we can do what we want, we're independent from the university, so thanks for having the meeting, but I'm going to go ahead and roll out of here and go back to doing my job.
And that job, again, was editor your senior year. You graduate from UNL, and I understand that one of your many jobs that you've done in media, in the press, you were a crime reporter in Arkansas for the Democrat Gazette.
Yeah, that was in Little Rock, Arkansas. I did that for, I guess, like 2 or 3 years right out of college. It was interesting. The best way to explain it is, first thing I would do in the morning is go into the office and turn on the police scanner and, you know, wait for a report of, you know, someone getting shot or killed or something else awful happened. And then before I even, you know, got a cup of coffee or whatever, I would call the coroner and ask who had been murdered overnight, get details on that. So it was a lot of, you know, just is when something would flash on the police scanner, I mean, I would just race across town, and it might be like we would have a 10 p.m. deadline and someone would get murdered at 9 p.m. across town. So I'd just like run out, race into my car, you know, haul across town, go talk to the cops, report on the scene. Like, I mean, there were times where there's just like a dead body out in the middle of the street with a crowd milling around, and, you know, talk to witnesses, talk to family if they're there, get back in the car, you know, race back to the office, and, you know, maybe I'd have like 5 minutes to write up a story and, you know, making sure I get every single detail right, because, you know, with that's the standards of journalism, like everything's, you got to have all the details, all the names right. So it was pretty intense.
And that's one of those things I've noticed as well, working in radio and having done both news and sports, as well as being a jock. If you get a name wrong, that phone's going to light up from, you know, somebody saying you misspelled their name, or perhaps you get the name right, and then you get the, you know, in maybe in your case, the alleged suspect, you get that name right, and then the phones light up saying you got to take his name out of there because he's innocent, and or you know, there are all types of circumstances that I've seen where no matter what, you can't please everybody when you're reporting on the news.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it's news for good reason, journalism for good reason has really high standards and should, but you get people are going to be upset about some stuff that is just like, all right, whatever.
I want to put a pin in your time in Arkansas, because we're going to come back and touch on that as we expand on your beginning in comics and graphic novels, but let's talk a little bit more about where else your journalism career has taken you.
Yeah, so after being in Little Rock, and that was, my wife and I met there, neither of us, of course, are from Arkansas, and we ended up, let's see, I guess it was 2008, we moved to Atlanta for her to go to law school, and so I wanted to try something a little bit different. I was a little bit burned out, I guess, from, you know, doing this crime reporting thing, which was, you know, so much negative news. So I transitioned into university alumni magazines. I worked for a little bit at Georgia State and then ended up at Georgia Tech and was there for a couple of years and ended up taking over their alumni magazine. So I've served, the past 2 years as editor of the magazine. We did a big redesign of the magazine that it's gotten a lot of awards. We were a medal finalist from the Society of Publications Designers, which the list of finalists is kind of crazy because it's like ESPN, the magazine, and the New Yorker, and, you know, all of these like top end consumer magazines. And then all of a sudden Georgia Tech Alumni Magazine. It's like, oh, all right. That's kind of cool.
And it's one of those things that maybe, is it weird for you, or do you have any actual alums from Georgia Tech, you know, coming up? Obviously they're proud of the magazine and how it looks and for its various honors and awards, but do they ever look out and be like, wait a minute, you're not even an alum from Georgia Tech?
Yeah, I definitely get that from time to time, and I mean, for good reason. And it's, I did a lot of work on the front end. Like, we had done a lot of market research on, you know, who our alums are, what they're interested in, and taking a lot of meetings to kind of get the pulse of the place and get to know things. And it's, Georgia Tech is a really, it's a cool place, which you know, I'm sure that some Nebraska fans don't have fond memories of Georgia Tech after the, was it 90 or 91 bowl loss?
You are getting before my time, but yeah, it was definitely early 90s in the heart of the Tom Osborne era.
Exactly. So, I don't know, it's a cool place. It's really fun in a way. It kind of helps me in my writing because it's this, you know, cutting edge research and technology institution. So there's all this like sci-fi type stuff going on of, you know, the melding of like computer technology and biology and space age electronics. And I mean, just all kinds of crazy stuff, nanotechnology. So, you know, I've always been really interested in science, even though I didn't study it, and I'm interested in incorporating science into my writing. So I get to see a lot of this stuff firsthand and meet the researchers and you know, really see what they're doing in the lab.
So let's talk a little bit about your writing now. And obviously, it from the journalist background, you have that writing background. You have that love of writing. Your grandmothers were both writers and poets, as you said, and from an early age, recognizing you know, comics and having that awareness. At what point did you start to think that, I don't know, maybe writing for comic books or graphic novels might be kind of fun?
So let's see. I guess it was like late college that I had actually given up on reading comics for several years. I like a lot of people. You know, there was the boom of the mid-90s that then turned into a pretty big bust where it was all, you know, like foil covers and all this ridiculous nonsense. And I remember being really turned off by the clone saga in the Spider-Man books. And so it was, you know, like early 2000s when I was in college that I had a couple of friends who, you know, they basically were people who knew a lot more about than I did. And because at that time, I mean, I still really hadn't had that much exposure. And I especially didn't know anything about, I mean, I hadn't read Watchmen. I hadn't read like Dark Knight Returns, any, you know, independent graphic novels I'd never seen. So I was kind of like a typical person who really associated comic books with superheroes, and I just didn't get that it was a much broader thing. So at that point, those friends really ushered me back, and you know, they took me to a comic book shop and put good books in my hand, and I started to get a sense of what comic books could do as a storytelling medium and started to rediscover my love for them. And so I started thinking about writing comic books at that point, but it wasn't until we were in Little Rock and I worked at the newspaper with Dusty Higgins, who is an illustrator who I collaborate with on the Pinocchio Vampire Slayer books. And, you know, we just really hit it off. We talked about comics all the time and we saw what was out there and we just thought, you know, why not?
And, you know, that's the pin that I wanted to go back to is your time in Little Rock and Dusty. And it seems like everybody has, you know, everybody that I've ran across who enjoys, you know, comic books, reading them and discussing them, they always have a friend, two friends, you know, maybe even a small group that they can just sit together and just talk about storylines, talk about, you know, past storylines, maybe pick up, you know, on a few of the independent titles here and there. And you know, I certainly have one or two, and it seems like you found one there just out of college with Dusty.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dusty is, he's just an insanely talented artist. I mean, he works a full-time job. He's still at the newspaper, and he can turn out two pages of comics a day, which, you know, most artists who draw full-time can barely manage to do one page a day. So he's just, you know, his career is already going great. I mean, there's going to be a certain point where he just blows up and, you know, he's not returning my calls anymore. But he's really just very passionate about comics and very thoughtful about constructing and storytelling and design. And so, you know, he actually it was just over the course of us being friends and talking about stuff. And one day he did this little sketch of kind of a bad Pinocchio character who had told a lie and his nose, you know, shot out and stabbed through a vampire. And he showed that to me and, you know, it was just like, man, that is such a clever idea. And it was actually not until after I had moved to Atlanta and had kind of forgotten about the sketch that Dusty did that he called me up and said, hey, do you want to make a book out of Pinocchio killing vampires? And I think it probably took me about like 0.5 seconds to say yes.
And again, it's Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. If you have a comic shop that you frequent, if they're worth anything, you can go up to them and you can ask them to order it. Otherwise, I know that Amazon has it. Let's talk about Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, because if you think about it, the concept, it seems so obvious. You know, in reading the backstory like I did, vampires killed Geppetto, Pinocchio, in a murderous, you know, vengeful state, does what only, you know, he can do. Tells a lie, stabs a vampire. He's got the tools. He's the living embodiment of a wooden stake.
Yeah, it was just such an obvious idea. And, you know, we get a lot of that, like the main response that people come to is like, oh man, I should have gotten that. And, you know, I should have done that. It's like, well, all right. You know, we're the ones that got there first, I guess. But I think the thing that's so much fun about the project is it's basically like a one panel cartoon. Like the sketch that Dusty did is really, I mean, that's all it is. It's like this one note joke. Pinocchio lies, nose grows out, stabs a vampire. Okay, it's a stake. Like, you get it. And what we set out to do was, okay, this is this very silly, very ridiculous thing, but can we make an actual good book out of it? And so we went back to the original Pinocchio story, which was written by an Italian writer, Carlo Collodi, in 1883. I always, whenever I talk about it, I say, go read the original. It's on Google Books or wherever. I mean, you can find it for free or very cheap, very easily. And it's a phenomenal story.
So what you're saying is we shouldn't go and watch Disney's Pinocchio?
Yeah, so we got all the way through doing the first Pinocchio book and had based it entirely on Collodi's version. And we had this realization that if people read our book, they would have no clue what in the heck was going on because it's so, so different from the Disney version, and most everyone knows the Disney version.
Of course.
And the most simple way to explain the difference is that in Carlo Collodi's original, the cricket, he's not called, you know, Jiminy, he's just called the talking cricket. The cricket shows up and is telling Pinocchio what to do and how to behave and to be a good boy and all that. And Pinocchio grabs a hammer and smashes the cricket and kills it.
Oh, no.
Just immediately. This is like right at the start of the book this happens. Just completely unprovoked, Pinocchio kills the cricket. And then the ghost of the cricket haunts Pinocchio and keeps, you know, hectoring him about behaving.
I can see why Disney would have taken another path on that.
Exactly. I mean, it's a little crazy. So, our version of the story has this ghost cricket, you know, hanging out with Pinocchio the entire time.
Gotta give it a shout out again. Pinocchio Vampire Slayer of Wood and Blood. You can check that out, like I said. But we got to recognize this because it was named to the 10 Great Graphic Novels for Teens list by YALSA. And if you're not familiar with YALSA, that's the Young Adult Library Services Association. So right away, getting recognized. And I look at that, you know, making that list, 10 Great Graphic Novels for Teens, it seems like that's sort of a voided market. You have so many graphic novels that are maybe geared, you know, more towards the, I don't want to say more mature reader, because, you know, I'm 30, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm mature. But it seems like there's not as much of a market in graphic novels for teens, but Pinocchio Vampire Slayer sort of helped fill that void.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting what's happened with comics. I mean, we went through so many years with comics where, there was this real reaction to the stigma that comics had as just being superheroes. And this all, I mean, I'm not going to go too far into all of this because I could really go down a rabbit hole, but comics were really ghettoized culturally for a long time, going back to Frederick Wortham and The Seduction of the Innocent. And if anyone's interested, I highly recommend a book called The 10-Cent Plague that goes into the history of comic books. I mean, there were comic book burnings where, you know, parents and teachers were destroying them. So comics just had this real stigma for a long time. And basically the only comic books that existed were, I mean, aside from some exceptions, it was like superheroes and Archie. And that was pretty much it. So there was this reaction to that of people doing really extreme, very adult, you know, mature type stuff. And there were all of these headlines of, you know, comics, they're not just for kids anymore. And I think that the industry kind of overreacted and got to a point where it's, you know, now it's almost like comics, they're not just for grown-ups anymore. They're
right.
Actually comic books for kids. And what's great is that that's happening at the same time that there's a lot of research coming out showing that comic books are very effective as a medium for teaching kids to read. And so there's a great growing interest by teachers, by librarians in comics. And for the Pinocchio books, that's really been our biggest audience. Like Dusty and I have gone to a lot of library and school events, and I always love going to those because you just see this, you know, infectious desire of the kids to read these comics. I mean, they just bury their faces in them and really absorb them.
And you know, I'm, like I said, I'm 30. I probably said it several times now, but I get looked at as, oh, you read comics. Aren't comics for kids? And no, I got to say really not, you know, maybe it's, and I'm not reading a lot of, you know, way out there stuff. I have Watchmen, of course, you know, Dark Knight Returns. I have all those, but at the same time, I'm stuck in Green Lantern land. And so that's going to really move us up to the point now. We have just had the end of the run of Geoff Johns on Green Lantern. It was close to a 10-year run, if it wasn't 10 years. And let's talk, before we talk about what we can expect from Green Lantern Corps, let's talk a little bit about Jeff's contributions, because they are many, numerous. I mean, he brought back Hal Jordan, gave us the Sinestro Corps, gave us, you know, not just the Sinestro Corps, but, you know, Larfleeze and Atrocitus and St. Walker and all these other, you know, Spectrums and Lantern Corps, and just did so much. Blackest Night, Brightest Day. And what a contribution he made, and really, I think, brought Hal Jordan, brought Green Lantern back into the mainstream.
Yeah, you have to give Jeff 100% of, well, I mean, not 100%, because obviously there's great artists and editors and other writers on the other books, but I mean, you have to give Jeff just a ton of credit for that. I think he's a really visionary writer. He thinks in the big picture, and he, you know, he set out with this sort of small scale story with Green Lantern Rebirth, in which he brought Hal Jordan back to life and reinstalled him as a Green Lantern. But you know, it was like this constant movement from one paradigm to another, and just always like always expanding the story, always expanding the universe. And you know, his contribution, just, I mean, he has to be right up there with, aside from the creators of Green Lantern, I mean, you have to put him right up there.
He expanded Green Lantern's universe, like you said, building on it, new titles coming out, including, you know, Agent Orange, you know, so much. I have, if I don't have the entire Geoff Johns run between single issues and, you know, trade paperbacks, I'm not missing much. I'll tell you, when I got back into comics, I took, you know, I had comics as a kid, was handed down some classic Marvel stuff from an uncle that I read, and unfortunately I didn't take care of them as a kid like I should have. But what really got me back into comics was Free Comic Book Day, and I want to say that it was 2010, and it was the very beginning of Blackest Night, And if it's not 2010, it was 2009. I don't know. I got married in 2009, so I don't think my wife would have let me go to Free Comic Book Day then. No, it was Blackest Night. The Blackest Night storyline brought me back. I've got, you know, Green Lantern Corps, New Guardians, Red Lantern, all in my pull list. I'm excited. Let's talk a little bit about Green Lantern Corps as you take over for an equally amazing writer in Peter Tomasi.
Yeah, I mean, Peter is leaving very big shoes to fill. He's really, I mean, you know, Jeff is kind of the guy that a lot of people talk about, but I think Peter gets his due a lot as a great writer, and I have a huge amount of respect for him and everything that he did, and it's definitely an honor to, you know, get to take the reins from him. You know, I think the really great thing about what Jeff and the other writers, Tony Bedard, deserves a good mention as well. What they did really well was with Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps issues number 20, they wrapped up this giant story that they had been telling, and they provided a lot of closure for the characters, for the readers, but they also introduced a really fascinating new status quo, and so it left a lot of great openings to explore. And I think one of the biggest things is, you know, you have this situation where between the rise of the Third Army and the wrath of the First Lantern, what you've seen is the Guardians have been really malevolent forces causing a lot of destruction across the universe. And people around the universe equate the Guardians with the Green Lantern. So it's not as if, you know, your average person off on planet wherever is going to say, oh, you know, the Guardians are evil, but the Green Lanterns are good. No, they just, you know, they equate all of this together. So we enter this new era where the Green Lanterns really aren't viewed as heroes anymore. Or at least there's a lot more skepticism about them as heroes. And so it's an interesting thing, and I think there's kind of a parallel to the role that the United States plays in the world. Often we're talked about as the, you know, the world's police force, which, you know, is great, and we do tons of good around the world. But then there's a really interesting question, which is, how do you police a people or a world or a place that does not want you there, that does not want your help? And we're going to be seeing a lot of that with the future of the Corps.
It's one of those very interesting things. And in Green Lantern Corps 20, you know, wrapping up Peter's work on it, left quite a few questions. I mean, obviously, if you've been reading New 52, then you know that Kyle Rayner is doing his thing as the White Lantern. And, you know, Hal Jordan at the beginning was kind of exiled and later killed. And if you read, and by now we shouldn't have spoilers. I believe Green Lantern 21 is out. But in Green Lantern 20, Geoff Johns' amazing finale, you kind of get a sense into, you know, how he, if he wrote it, you know, for the next 20 years, where he would end up taking the story, Hal and Carol Ferris getting married. You know, you have the fire of Kyle Rayner, you know, that spark continuing to burn bright. You have Guy Gardner just being kind of a badass and in a bar and not necessarily looking for a fight, but able to handle a threat. And you've got Jon Stewart, who's gone on to become a state senator or some kind of lawmaker to help people in that regard. So that's a little bit how he wrapped it up. As we look at how Green Lantern Corps finished up, you had, you know, Jon Stewart, Mogo, the Green Lantern Mogo, the planet, reformed. You have Jon Stewart there with a Star Sapphire of his affection. They're enjoying a nice romantic moment. Meanwhile, Guy is heading to Earth to save his family from Zar. He uses a supercharged power ring and incinerates Zar. You see the what happens in a nuclear blast, that just that kind of shadowy figure is all that remains. But there's also a little bit of foreshadowing, and I believe it was in the Rage of the Red Lanterns 20, where it says Guy Gardner not only joining the Red Lanterns, but possibly leading them. Now, I'm not going to ask you for spoilers, because that's not fair to you, to me, and all the other readers, but what can we expect in your run from on the Green Lantern Corps?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting point to pick up. So I think it's out there enough that I'm not spoiling anything by saying Guy Gardner is not going to have a presence in Green Lantern Corps in the immediate future. We'll be seeing a lot more of him and what's going on with him in Red Lanterns. The book is really focused on John Stewart now, and it's part of there are these four Earth Lanterns, and a lot of times they're either grouped together in a book, or you know, they one gets more play at one time and more prominence. But what we have now is, you know, Hal is the main character in Green Lantern. John is the main character in Green Lantern Corps. We'll be seeing Guy in Red Lanterns. And Kyle, of course, in New Guardians. So it's a great opportunity, I think, to kind of explore John Stewart's character in depth that maybe it hasn't been, I think, since Green Lantern Mosaic. I just don't think he's gotten the focus. So the thing that I really love about John Stewart and his character is he's a thinker and he's a builder. And so we pick up with a Green Lantern Corps that's really just been decimated. The Guardians are, for the most part, dead and gone. And you know, Hal Jordan is taking over, but there's a really big leadership vacuum going on within the Corps. And because things have changed so dramatically, you know, you have to wonder, you know, what, like, if you're a member of the Corps, what's our mission now? What do we do? What do we stand for? How do we govern ourselves? And those are kind of the big picture questions that John is grappling with. And he's going to provide a lot of leadership in building this next stage of the Corps, kind of a post-Guardian era. And, you know, obviously Hal will play a huge, huge role in that as well. But at the same time, you know, John is entering this relationship with Fatality, who they have a very long, tortured history. He holds himself responsible for destroying her home planet. She spent years trying to murder him. So, you know, they don't necessarily, they aren't really getting off on the best foot with their relationship. So he's got a lot of, you know, complicated personal things that he's dealing with. And then this whole trying to figure out what's going on with the Corps. And then with issue 21, we'll see the introduction of a new and old threat. This is out there. So if anyone wants to plug their ears or whatever, but we'll be seeing the return of the Durlans, and they're really going to play a pretty major role going forward as a threat to the Corps.
One Green Lantern that we neglected to mention, he is an Earth Green Lantern, and kind of joined on or hopped on the team in the new 52, and that's Simon Baz. What where does he fit in to these four Lantern titles?
Simon is not going to have a role really of any prominence in the immediate future in any of these books. He's really active on Earth. All of the main Green Lantern books are very much, you know, big epic sci-fi space adventure kind of stories. And so we're really focusing on what's going on out in the universe, whereas, you know, Jeff is still, you know, writing a ton of books that are taking place on Earth. And so that's where we'll see Lantern Baz having a big presence.
One of the things that we didn't touch on certainly needs to be addressed is how you got the gig for Green Lantern Corps. We talked about Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, and then we kind of jumped right into the Green Lantern talk, but we never got to how you became associated with DC.
Yeah, so around the time I moved to Atlanta, I actually had written on the side of the newspaper, I'd written a column about comics, reviewing comics. And one of the books that I reviewed and really loved was it was first a series of comics and then was republished as a collection. It was a sci-fi story called The Surrogates. It's published by Top Shelf Productions. And I ended up interviewing the author of that book, Rob Venditti, who now is the writer of Green Lantern. And when I moved to Atlanta, Rob and I had a good conversation when I interviewed him, and I just, sent him a note and said, "Hey, I just moved to Atlanta. You want to hang out sometime?" And it turned out that he was doing a signing at a comic shop really near where I lived, and it was a free comic book. It would have been like Free Comic Book Day 2008, and I don't think I've told anyone this story, so this is, you can market this as an exclusive reveal.
Boom. Nerds United exclusive right here.
So I went to this comic book shop, and Rob was just finishing up signing stuff, and the guys who run the shop had kind of handed him a bunch of, different, free issues and some little, I think it was HeroClix toys or different things. And then one of the things that they had handed him was a Green Lantern ring, the kind of the fake plasticky.
I have four
from that year. And so Rob and I were talking, and this was ages before, this is, 5 years before Rob gets hired by DC. So he has no connection to them. And Rob had all this stuff, and he looked at me, he's like, "Hey man, I don't really want any of this stuff. I don't have anywhere to put it. Do you want anything?" And honestly, I didn't really want to take anything, but I felt bad turning it down. So I accepted the Green Lantern ring just as a, to be nice kind of thing. And so I still have, it's sitting on my desk, this little plastic Green Lantern ring that Rob gave me the first time we met.
That is awesome, and I'm sure you look at it all the time. Maybe when your willpower is a little low.
Exactly, I've got it here for motivation.
So we talked just. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say. So the end of the story with Rob is that Rob got hired to work at DC, and not very exciting thing, but passed my books along to the editors. And when the opening came up on Green Lantern Corps, they gave me a call, and rest is history.
And I'm really looking forward to it. Like I said, my Green Lantern fandom transcends the paper. It transcends the film, both the big screen film and the direct videos. It is on my arm in the form of a tattoo. I'm Green Lantern for life. And we talked just a few minutes ago about spoilers, and that's what I want to talk to you about, because it seems, it's 2013. You can't avoid spoilers, especially when you have a really massive event like the death of Robin. What are your thoughts? And if it's obviously you want to help, sell comics, but is there a better way to do that than giving away massive plot points?
Yeah, it's really tough, because the way that, and this is all really new to me, because I'm kind of seeing things behind the scenes for the first time, but the way that comic books are solicited to retailers, it always takes place several months ahead of time. So retailers are deciding right now if they're going to buy, issues that are, very, very far from being completed. So, several months from actually being out on the shelves. So you have to provide information to the retailers to get them excited. And part of what gets retailers excited is seeing fans getting excited. And so the way that you get fans excited is by dropping knowledge. But obviously, like, you know, there's stuff that I have, like an example with the Durlans being a villain in this issue of Green Lantern Corps. Well, there's a reveal in issue 21 that the Durlans are the villain, but like that issue doesn't come out until next week, but there was a solicit that was out, I think like 3 weeks ago, that was for a future issue that talks about the Durlans as a threat. And it's, I don't know, it's definitely a complicated thing. I mean, I guess, you know, fans can kind of pick and choose what they want to read and what they want to read into. I personally try to avoid spoilers for stuff, but it's definitely hard.
Yeah, when you're looking at Facebook or Twitter or something and something pops up in your timeline or your news feed and it says, you know, breaking news, DC plans to off such and such character, whether you intend to read it or not, you sometimes, you know, are left without a choice. Of course, the death of Damian Wayne thing was spoiled for me. Didn't matter. Still went out and read it. And, you know, found Batman Incorporated 8 to be very, you know, kind of a nice farewell for Damian. And that's certainly Grant Morrison. And since he created the character, he can kind of do with him what he wants. We talk a lot, Nerds United, I say we talk, but since this is the first podcast, we will talk quite a bit about nerds. And around here, we use the term nerd as a term of endearment. So with that said, Van, I want to ask who you think are the three biggest nerds in all of nerddom. And you know, maybe people you know or people you've worked with or celebrities that you maybe don't happen to know. I'm going to try to keep a running tally of all the people that I talk to, and maybe, you know, in 6 months or so we can have a definitive, this guy's the biggest nerd.
That's a cool idea. I think you have to put Joss Whedon at the top of that list or right at the top of that list, just because, I mean, he clearly cares and clearly knows a great deal and has a lot of power and uses it in a good way. I have two connections to Joss Whedon. Both of them happened at Comic-Con. Last year, I sat at the table next to him eating breakfast one morning and resisted the urge to bother him. And a previous year, I accidentally ran into him and almost knocked him over in the halls of Comic-Con, except I didn't realize that it was Joss Whedon that I ran into, and it was Dusty who pointed it out to me later. So I still feel kind of bad about that.
That was perhaps your golden moment to shine.
I know, like, we could have formed a lifelong bond in that moment when I, you know, shoulder charged him. But
you could have been co-creator of the Avengers or co-director or have some line on that.
I know. I clearly just bungled away my future. So let's see. I really enjoy Patton Oswalt, and I think he's another guy who is just a really passionate fan who has influence in the community and again, you know, wields his power in a good way and brings a lot of awareness to comics in a good way. And his little monologue on Parks and Rec when he talks about the X-Men mashup with Star Wars is...
Oh, that was brilliant.
That was just epic. I think, you know, that's like, if you haven't watched it, go watch that right now. I'm trying to think of who I should throw out there. So a guy who is one of my favorite nerds is a writer and artist named Matt Kint. And he is writing a bunch of stuff for DC, some stuff for Marvel. And he has a book called Mind Management for Dark Horse that's great that he both writes and draws. And Matt is just a phenomenal guy, brilliant creator, and if you love comics, you should seek out every single thing that he does and buy it.
Excellent. That one, we'll call it a dark horse candidate, perhaps. So, last question, but it might be the most important question of all. Star Trek or Star Wars?
I guess I'm going to have to go with Star Wars, although I really hate to admit this, but I'm not a huge fan of either. I enjoy both, but man, I'm going to get crucified for this probably.
I got to say though, if they're still listening at this point, I think you're okay.
All right. I would pick Star Wars just on the strength of Empire Strikes Back. I think that's a phenomenal movie. You can look at it as a sci-fi epic and it's great, or you can just look at it as a great dramatic movie with brilliant writing and acting. It holds up in every way. Star Trek I enjoy. I think I kind of discovered it late and didn't get into it as much as other people did.
Have you had a chance to see the latest Star Trek film?
No, I haven't. I've been swamped the past like 3 months, so I saw Iron Man 3, and I think that's the only movie I've seen in the past like 6 months or so. It's been kind of bad. I need to catch up. I still haven't even seen like the Spider-Man movie from last summer, or I think there are a handful of others.
I'll say this about The Amazing Spider-Man. I went in there with very low expectations. And not only were my expectations met, they were exceeded. I found it to be enjoyable, a good one to rent. I don't own it, but definitely a solid one to rent. Like you, Iron Man 3, I saw it. Haven't seen Star Trek Into Darkness yet. But what's the one? Got to be excited for Man of Steel.
Yeah, you know, the early trailers for that I was a little bit skeptical of. I think superhero movies, some of them have been a little bit, you know, not to point fingers, but some have been a little kind of morose lately. And I was worried that it was going to be very, you know, self-serious and navel-gazing based on some of the early trailers. But the recent trailers look awesome. It really looks good. And Michael Shannon is just an amazing actor, so I'm really excited to see him as General Zod. That's brilliant, brilliant casting.
At what point, how long do you have to be at DC before you get some advanced screenings on some of these summer blockbusters?
Well, I can tell you exactly where you have to be on the ladder. So I am not getting to go to any advanced screenings, but Mr. Vendetti is getting to go to an advanced screening. So I've got that, you know, one or two more rungs I've got to hoist myself up.
Obviously, getting ready. Well, you have started your work on Green Lantern Corps. Got to remind everybody that Green Lantern Corps number 21 hits your local comic shop coming up on Wednesday, which is always New Comic Book Day, Wednesday, June 12th. I can't recommend enough to go out there and check it out. It's going to be a new story. Is it one that, if they haven't been reading even stuff from the New 52, do they have to, you know, go out and buy those all those back issues right away and read them to get caught up? Or because it's a new creative team, can they start kind of fresh with number 21 and not feel like they're missing anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to have the entire backstory there to catch people up, but I think people would be pretty comfortable jumping on fresh with it. I mean, I would recommend a lot of the old stuff just because Peter and Jeff are great writers. So if you haven't read that yet and pick up this new issue and feel compelled to go explore the past of Green Lantern, there's a lot of great stuff there, but you can definitely come in, you know, knowing nothing other than the title, and fingers crossed you're going to enjoy it.
One thing we didn't talk about is the artist and ink and colors and who's the art team starting with Green Lantern Corps 21.
Bernard Chang is doing both pencils and inks, and he's someone I've admired for years. I mean, he's just a legendary creator. He has great storytelling in his style. A very just thoughtful, hardworking guy, and I'm really blown away by the stuff that shows up in my inbox from him. It's great, and I'm getting to meet him this weekend at Heroes Con, so that's exciting. And then Marcello Maiolo is doing the colors, and I think colorists don't really get enough attention and enough credit, but Marcello is phenomenal. It doesn't look like any Green Lantern book I've ever seen before, but it also looks in a way like kind of what I would imagine a Green Lantern book would look like. So I don't know. It's really phenomenal work. They're making me look a lot better than I am.
And it's one of those too, because, you know, Green Lantern, and we've talked about this, the Green Lantern universe is very much a space centered, whereas many other heroes are you know, earthbound. You have an opportunity really to open up that color palette and not necessarily explore or have, you know, an adventure, but really, you know, kind of see what you can do with a lot of those colors. I've seen some of the artwork that's been posted on DC's website. It looks good. I'm not going to lie. But then again, you know, for me, maybe it's because of my fandom, but Green Lantern, you know, and the art and the writing always just seems to fit real well.
Yeah, I think the thing that Marcello is doing is, you know, this is all light-based power, so he's doing some really innovative things with lighting effects, and I love stuff like that, you know, it's there, and like, if you want to read things on a more subtextual level, you can appreciate it, but you don't, you know, you can also just look at it and think it looks awesome, but I don't know, it's a really cool universe. Like, one of the things I love about Green Lanterns is, like, as your power, you have this ring that can create essentially whatever, you know, you can envision and whatever you can imagine. So your only limitation really is your own imagination. And in a way, that's kind of a cool analog for a writer, because, like, me as the writer, you know, I am creating what these Green Lanterns are doing, and so I can create whatever I want for their, you know, power constructs to be. So, you know, my only limitation is my own imagination. It's just a neat kind of like analog on a metatextual level.
And it's one of those, when you talk about some of the Earth Green Lanterns, Kyle Rayner by day was an artist. And as you mentioned, John Stewart, who, again, be the focus of Green Lantern Corps, is a builder, also spent some time in the military, so you can really build on that, no pun intended, to make his constructs and make his you know, mind that much more real.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you really you want to get in the heads of the characters and make... I mean, make their actions, make their dialogue, and also make their constructs very fitting to who they are. And that's something that I've really focused on a lot in writing. And so you'll see a lot of John's character shining through in that.
Green Lantern Corps, number 21, again, hitting stores on June 12th. Pick it up. And while you're there, pick up the other Green Lantern titles. And... anything else that's of interest to you? I love my monthly trips to the comic book store, and I'm excited to get out there and pick up Green Lantern Corps number 21. I got to thank you so much, Van, for joining me on the debut episode of Nerds United. The bar, it has been set very high, and it's not going to be any easy task for me to try to top the mark that we set here this week in the first episode.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to kick the show off with you.
And that'll be it for the first episode of Nerds United. A precedent has been set that will be difficult to meet, but the challenge, that one lies with me. All you have to do is tune in for the next episode of Nerds United.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.